Good evening. Trump pardons a war criminal. Elizabeth Warren calls for impeachment, and Uber drivers and others prepare to strike. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Tuesday, May 7th, 2019. And President Donald Trump is facing heavy criticism for pardoning a former U.S. soldier once sentenced to 25 years in prison for murdering an Iraqi prisoner in 2009. The White House announced on Monday that Trump signed an executive grant of clemency, a full pardon for Michael Behena. The 35-year-old was convicted and sentenced to 25 years in prison by a military court for the killing of an Iraqi prisoner suspected of being part of al-Qaeda. Behena shot and killed Ali Mansour Mohammed in 2008 after he took him to a railroad culvert for questioning about without authorization instead of taking him home as instructed. Behena stripped and questioned the prisoner at gunpoint about a roadside bombing that killed two members of a platoon under his command. In a statement, Sarah Sanders said Behena's case has attracted broad support from the military, Oklahoma elected officials, and the public, but the ACLU lambasted the president for pardoning a convicted murderer and war criminal. At least two people were injured in a shooting at a charter school in Highland Ranch, Colorado, a suburb of Denver, this afternoon. All schools in the county are on lockdown, and the authorities are searching for a possible third suspect. According to the Douglas County Sheriff's Office, multiple people were shot at the K-12 STEM school on Tuesday afternoon. Police are currently searching the school classroom by classroom for what they say is a tentative third suspect. Meanwhile, in Washington, Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, who is a candidate for president, concluded a speech on the Senate floor Tuesday by asking for Congress to begin impeachment proceedings against President Trump.
The information that has been given to us in the Mueller report clearly constitutes adequate information to begin an impeachment proceeding in the House of Representatives. No matter how many times Mitch McConnell or the rest of the Republicans want to wish that away, it's there in black and white in the report. I urge every Republican in this chamber, I urge every Republican and Democrat in Congress, I urge every person in this country to read the Mueller report. Robert Mueller makes clear that the President of the United States worked actively to obstruct justice. There is enough here to bring an impeachment proceeding. And for us, for this body, for Congress, to back up from that and to say that protecting the President is more important than protecting the Constitution is not only wrong, it is a violation of our oath of office. I'm here to say one more time in publicly, this is not a fight I wanted to take on, but this is the fight in front of us now. This is not about politics. This is about the Constitution of the United States of America. We took an oath not to try to protect Donald Trump. We took an oath to protect and serve the Constitution of the United States of America. And the way we do that is we begin impeachment proceedings now against this president.
The remarks came in response to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's attempt earlier on Tuesday to firmly shut the door on the ongoing controversy surrounding the report. While Democrats continue to demand congressional testimony from Mueller and former White House counsel Don McGahn. Most other candidates for president have treaded carefully around the impeachment question since the Mueller report was released. And controversy continues at the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, where activists calling themselves the Embassy Protection Collective mark 30 days occupying the building they say they're protecting on behalf of the elected government of President Nicolas Maduro. One of the protectors is Kevin Zeese. He says right-wing opponents failed to prevent a food delivery earlier on Tuesday.
Someone ordered food to be delivered by Amazon. It came this morning, and the police allowed the opposition, the violent opposition, to block delivery, which is interesting because the police Secret Service says that they are not blocking delivery, but in the last 2 days, they blocked delivery of food yesterday, actually tossed it into the trash can, and then they blocked delivery today. But we now have an outside group that's there every day. We have a 4-7 rally, plus people there throughout the day. And some of those outside protectors, embassy protection protectors, took the bags of food, and we arranged with them to get the food in the building. We threw a large bag out past the sidewalk, past the police barrier, into the street, and they were to fill the bag with the Amazon delivered food. And I'm no fan of Amazon, by the way. Just mentioned that's how it came. We pulled it up from the street into the second floor window, and successfully got that first bag. And that was not all the food that was delivered. And so, about an hour later, because the opposition then came around to try to block us, we sent a second bag out, and were successful in getting that pulled into the window. Amazingly, so we've had those two successes today, and that's not the only successes. We've had multiple successes of people getting through the barriers created by the opposition, the violent opposition outside, and by the Secret Service, and get food in. So we have a stockpile of food. We are restricting our meal to two a day because we're planning to be here for a long haul, and we appreciate people's efforts to get food in, and we really appreciate people's efforts to come to Washington, D.C., go across the street of the embassy and be part of the Embassy Protection Collective outside to show support for the effort that's going on to stop this U.S. coup in Venezuela. And we plan to stay as long as necessary to protect this embassy in solidarity with the people of Venezuela.
Who are you protecting it from? I mean, you said there was some people out there who were protesting, counter-protesters. When did they show up, and what have they been doing?
We're protecting the embassy from U.S. violation of international law. People who live in the United States who are from Venezuela, who left Venezuela, come from the wealthier classes. They don't represent the Venezuelan people. They represent the wealthier classes that used to do well before Chavez. They've come to Washington, D.C. and Florida and other cities, and that's who the opposition is outside. And so we're protecting the embassy from U.S. violating the Vienna Convention and entering the embassy and handing it over to a coup government to create a government in exile.
You call them violent. What do you mean by violent?
Oh, boy, that's been a series of things. People who try to deliver us food are assaulted by the violent opposition. And sadly, when they are assaulted and knocked to the ground and the food taken, the police arrest the victim of the assault, not the people who are doing the assault. Obviously, the police are siding with the opposition. They have loud noisemakers, sound cannons, and all sorts of ways to make very loud noise to try to cause violence inside our ears. They have strobe lights to try to blind us. They threaten people with murder. They threaten people with rape. They use racist attacks on our black members of the collective, looking like apes and holding out bananas. This is a racist, misogynist group of people who are in the opposition. And the reason why they're doing it is because the U.S. cannot lawfully come into this embassy. The U.S. violates the Vienna Convention. It puts U.S. embassies around the world at risk because it says the Vienna Convention no longer applies. And that means trouble for U.S. embassies. So they're unleashing this opposition on us in order to try to intimidate us, in order to try to starve us out, in order to get us to leave voluntarily. But we're not going to do it. We are having the opposite effect. When we are intimidated, we unify. We support each other. And this group is more determined than ever to stay and protect this embassy and not let this opposition try to intimidate us into leaving.
Kevin Cease is a member of the Embassy Protection Collective. He's reporting from inside the Venezuelan embassy in Georgetown. Meanwhile, in New York, WBAI's Daniel Vila, who produces La Voz Latina on Sunday evenings, spoke with Berna Ellerin from ILPS, the International League of People's Struggle, on their activism regarding what they call U.S. aggression against the Maduro government.
Well, first and foremost, the ILPS released statements. Has been releasing statements in support of the Venezuelan people for quite some time now. But as of, we still stand in firm support of the Venezuelan people in their overall struggle for genuine liberation and self-determination, and especially in defense of their U.S.-led imperialist attacks and destabilization. We demand an end to the sanctions, the U.S.-led sanctions, which is an act of war against the Venezuelan people. And we hold U.S. imperialism as primarily responsible for any destabilization attempt. And we do not recognize the so-called presidency of Juan Guaido.
What is the opinion of ILPS, the International League of People's Struggle, regarding what should be done next with regards to the situation by people living in the United States?
we are very much interested in building more people-to-people relations in Venezuela. ILPS members that are based in D.C. have been mobilizing to the Venezuelan consulate and also supporting the initiators of the standoff, you know, against the fascist police and state forces that are trying to take over the Venezuelan embassy. We have been supporting them from and also defending them in the attacks against them.
Bernard Ellerin, then, from the International League of People Struggle.
And that's WBAI's Daniel Vila speaking with Berna Ellerin. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo arrived in Iraq Tuesday amid escalating tensions with Iran. The surprise visit to Baghdad came after the State Department abruptly canceled a planned trip to Berlin, citing pressing issues. The already dire relationship between Washington and Tehran further deteriorated this week after the Trump administration announced Sunday a U.S. carrier strike group is headed to the region in response to unspecified, troubling, and escalatory indications and warnings. And those are the Secretary of State's words. The Pentagon reported Tuesday it was rushing B-52 bombers to the Middle East. Each plane can carry up to 70,000 pounds of bombs. The Abraham Lincoln, the aircraft carrier, which already was scheduled for deployment to the Persian Gulf region, is being rushed there ahead of schedule with a wing of air warplanes and 3,000 sailors aboard. It's accompanied by the USS Leyte Gulf, a guided missile cruiser, and four destroyers, the USS Bainbridge, Gonzales, Mason, and Nitze. Alessandro Bruno is an expert on geopolitics and a commentator often heard on RT and other progressive media. He says Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is playing a dangerous game.
It's rare that you have a president so detached from foreign policy, on the one hand, and on the other, with such ambitious foreign policy goals. I mean, on the destroying the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA, was a huge undertaking because many countries were involved. It took a few years of diplomacy, and Trump managed to get that off his agenda because Trump is more than interested in foreign policy. What he's interested in is being a manager. So he's going through his checklist of promises that he's made to voters and perhaps more importantly, checklist of things that his voters will expect when the presidential campaign gets fully underway. The problem is because he's unaware of many nuances of foreign policy, I don't think he really understands much or wants to geography, history, and these details. He's just going through his agenda and what needs to get done. And he's got these two people around him who may not even agree with each other. And I'm talking about Mike Pompeo and John Bolton, who have different backgrounds and different agendas. These two are eager to please, and they're eager to advance their own careers, especially Mike Pompeo. He's the one I would watch out for.
Let's talk about risks. How are his moves in different parts of the world, particularly in the Persian Gulf, risky, and what are they risking?
The aircraft carrier, it was the Lincoln, left Norfolk, Virginia, I think almost a month ago, or maybe even over a month ago. It was on a scheduled mission, as it is, the aircraft carrier group. And of course, the U.S. has a number of bases and fleets and equipment throughout in the Gulf. What's different is the fact that Bolton and Pompeo have attached Iran as the goal, and this comes in the wake of Trump declaring the Iranian Revolutionary Guard terrorist group, and this is an institution within the Iranian government. This is quite a first. Iran is under increasing sanctions pressure. The nuclear deal has been dismantled, and more restrictions have been put on Iran's nuclear research. What Trump may hope to achieve is to have an implosion in Iran, to cause the government in Iran to rupture under the pressure of the sanctions and the fact that it's affecting the population and causing another revolution. After all, we do know Iran is capable of revolution since there was a big one in 1979. I think all of that may backfire because Iran has survived under heavier sanctions than these in some cases and war in the 1980s. So Iranians are very nationalist and they do tend to rally around the country regardless of their political orientation. What may happen is that the policy of causing the Iranian government to collapse may backfire on the administration, and then Trump will be put to the wall, especially against in the context of a political campaign, and pleasing his voters, he may give in to the suggestions of his hawkish duo of collaborators, you know, Pompeo and Bolton. Bolton has proven throughout his career he really wants to dominate the legal agenda, the international legal. He challenges international law and insists that it is in the U.S. right to impose certain policies. Pompeo is a careerist. He's very smart, but he's smart in the ambitious sense. He wants to move up, and he's moved up very quickly, after all. He's a CIA director, and all of a sudden finds himself Secretary of State. He's only 54 years old, I think. You always have to watch out for people like Pompeo. He's trying to make a name of himself, and he may want to be Pompeo of Arabia or of Iran.
What would happen if the United States were to actually launch missiles or fight with Iran?
We have a few precedents, and I mean, I'm old enough to remember the attacks in the Persian Gulf in the 1980s when oil tankers were escorted by ships, by military ships. And remember, we had an incident, a famous incident in 1988 when the USS Vincennes shot down an Iranian airliner by mistake with a missile. So that's the kind of thing that could happen, is a super militarized traffic route for oil tankers and other ships, and you get the opportunities for mistakes and accidents like this, and you create the tensions that could escalate. I mean, Iran could definitely make things very difficult for the United States in Iraq. After all, Iraq and Iran share a Shiite-dominated government. So now you have Iran and Iraq in a much closer relations.
Could the U.S. try something like it did with Iraq and invade a huge army into Iraq? And Iran doesn't seem like to be Iraq, you know, but it's at the same time, it's not particularly strong compared to the U.S.
And that's the danger. I think that's the danger that an unchecked Pompeo might decide to do. And that's the problem with Trump being so ignorant of what's really happening in foreign policy and trusting these people so much. It could lead to that kind of mistake. But And with a defense secretary who's really not a military person. Mattis probably, although a hawk himself, was probably much more cautious about adventurisms of that kind. You know, and the danger, of course, going into Iran, this is a country of over 70 million, huge. It's one of the biggest countries in the region. It's the kind of country that would not buckle down. It would be, I mean, Iraq did not turn out to be a cakewalk. Imagine Iran. They have a strong national and cultural identity.
Well, we could take out their government, put in our own puppet government, but then have to fight a civil war forever in the hills.
Yes, the strategy for now, barring an incident, and this is what could happen, is a mistake that causes what in Latin, casus belli, you know, the case for war. And that's what could happen with the aircraft carrier and with the increasing pressure. Now, the easier route, diplomatic route, would have been to allow the nuclear agreement to stay and, in fact, improve relations, because the more you improve relations, the more strength you give to the Iranian reformers, to the people who want better relations with everybody. The way Trump is behaving, he's strengthening the hardliners in Iran. He's strengthening the people like Khamenei, not Rouhani. Rouhani is on the defensive. He's trying to defend even maintaining the nuclear agreement with the rest of the world powers, you know, the European Union, England, China, and Russia. If push comes to shove anymore, then Rouhani will be forced to cancel even that. And at that point, the U.S. will be forced to do something, because that agreement was what prevented the U.S. from having to save face, especially with Israel, and target one of the Iranian nuclear facilities. Mm-hmm. If the U.S. doesn't do it, Israel will, and then it will drag the United States into a war. So the situation is extremely dangerous now, and it's not run by people who, you know, with delicate hands.
Alessandro Bruno is an expert on geopolitics and a commentator often heard on RT and other progressive media. In New York and worldwide, a call for a general strike by drivers for Uber, Lyft, and other app-based ride-hailing companies is coming on the day that Uber makes its initial public offering, or IPO, on Wall Street. The offering is expected to net the company millions, but activists say those riches on Wall Street are built on highly exploited workers who make less than minimum wage while facing possible replacement by self-driving cars. Bhairavi Desai is the executive director of the Taxi Workers Alliance.
There is a global strike plan for tomorrow, May 8th. Everywhere from, you know, Los Angeles to London, New York City in between, and across the globe.
What is the purpose of this strike, and how is it going to happen?
Well, this particular date was chosen because this week Uber is expected to debut on the stock market, and they're looking for a valuation of $100 billion. Meanwhile, drivers are barely earning minimum wage. In their filings toward their IPO, Uber has said drivers should expect to be increasingly dissatisfied as they plan to cut incentives and cut fares, you know, cut payments to drivers even more. And of course, both Uber and Lyft are trying to move as fast as possible toward driverless cars. I mean, these companies have always treated drivers as if they're expendable. I mean, study after study has shown that drivers earn below the minimum wage. In New York City, up until 2 months ago, 85% of drivers were found to earn below minimum wage. But even at minimum wage, that's not enough, especially after drivers have had so many losses for all of these years, and while these companies go for billions in valuation. Secondly, these companies fire drivers at will without any notice. They call it deactivation. You know, you're fired overnight. There is no notice. There is no place to go to court to appeal. And meanwhile, you're not only out of income, but you still have to pay for the vehicle that you purchased in order to go to work for them. And so there's a cycle of poverty and debt, you know. And again, at the same time, these companies are trying to become some of the world's largest, you know, most wealthiest companies, all at the expense of one of the largest poor workforces.
What is going to happen with this strike? What does it mean?
The strike, it's a global day of strikes, and it was, the idea was sparked by our sister organization in Los Angeles. Number of cities have started to join, not only in the U.S., but also, you know, across the world. And so in New York City, the strike time is from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. So we're calling on all Uber, Lyft, Via, Juno drivers to turn off the app. And we're asking members of the public to also turn off the app for those 2 hours. Don't cross our strike line. And then throughout the day, we're going to be gathering with a main demonstration at 1 p.m. outside the Uber Lyft headquarters in Long Island City.
What happens next? What do you expect to come out of this?
Well, this is just the beginning. You know, striking is the hardest choice that workers make, but it's also the most powerful. And so after years of being kept at poverty wages, now being told their replacement by driverless cars is any day now, this is our show of force to say to Uber, Lyft, and all its Wall Street backers that the workers are not just going to go quietly into the night. We're standing up, we're fighting back, we're demanding livable incomes and job security.
Bhairavi Desai is the executive director of the Taxi Workers Alliance. And finally, after nearly 3 years of fighting for the rights to hold ceremony on their land, the Ramapo Lenape received justice, EarthMum reports.
On Friday, Judge Robert Wilson signed an order dismissing a lawsuit by the Ramapo Hunt and Polo Club Association against the Ramapo Lenape. Ramapo Hunt and Polo Club is a luxury housing development situated adjacent to the Ramapo Lenape land. They wanted to bar the Ramapo from using the land in Mahwah, New Jersey. The Ramapo Lenape chief is Dwayne Perry.
I very much also think it was, in a way, a victory for the Constitution, because these people were about to avoid the whole thing, talking about you can't pray on your own land in America, you can't assemble. They're basic tenets to our entire democracy. So I think even if it wasn't a big deal at the moment, at some point, people would have woke up down the road going, we have a president, say, here in Morwalk.
The Center for Constitutional Rights, which represents the tribe in their federal court case, said in a statement the injunction was a blatant attempt to force the Ramapo off sacred land they own and have used for religious practice and cultural assemblies for generations. The court correctly saw through this blatant attempt to use the legal process to target a specific group on the basis of race and religion, the center said. And there is more good news for the Ramapo Lenape this week, as Chief Duane Perry was given a humanitarian award from New Jersey Senator Menendez on Sunday, May 5th. Earthmum, WBAI News, New York.
And that's some of the news for Tuesday, May 7th, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry, Earth Mum, and Daniel Villa. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for joining us.